Erlon Brown, and I'm the village pastor here, and we're doing a book review or whatever on this book, Iron John by Robert Bly. Is there anyone here who has not heard of this book? All right, is there anyone here who has read it? Oh, okay. All right. Well,
how about those who understood it?
Well, I must say something at the beginning, and that is that it says on the cover that this is a book for men. And if there are things that you don't understand and you're a woman, well, that's the reason why. Now, I know women don't like to hear that, but that's just the truth as far as this book is concerned. The book is based on a Grimm's fairy tale, and it's a fairy tale about, it's a long fairy tale, and I kind of don't want to go into it. But if there are spots where we should come up on it where you should know something about the story, I'll tell you about it. Well, let me just give you a rundown anyway. This boy is playing, one day they go and they fish this wild man up out of the pond, and they put him in a cage. And this two-year-old boy is playing, and he's playing with this little golden ball, and he's rolling it around. And he rolls it by the Iron Man's cage, and the Iron Man, or Iron John, takes this ball. And the boy says, "Give me the ball back," and Iron John says, "No." And the boy says, "Well, I want it back, give it back to me." And the Iron John says, "I'll give it back to you if you let me out." The boy says, "Well, I can't let you out, I have to get the key." And Iron John says, "Go get the key." And the boy is not sure where the key is, he thinks his father has it, and then he realizes that the key is under his mother's pillow. And he has to get this key from out under his mother's pillow. And so he does this, and then he goes away with Iron John, because Iron John promises him some adventure and a good time. So he leaves with Iron John, and he goes to the pond, and Iron John says, "Sit here by the pond, and I'll be back." And he goes down under the pond, and he comes back. And he tells the guy, "Whatever you do," he tells the boy, "whatever you do." Now this, you know, this can take 10 years in fairy tale life. So he tells the boy, "Whatever you do, don't touch the pond." So the boy said, "Okay." So he's out frolicking around in the grass, pricks his finger on something. Without thinking, he sticks his finger in the pond to get it cooled off, and his finger turns gold. Iron John comes up and says, "How you doing?" And the boy says, "Okay." Iron John says, "What are you hiding?" And the boy said, "Nothing." And he says, "Let me see your finger." And the boy's finger was gold. So Iron John says, "Well, you're not supposed to do that, but I'll let it slide this time." He goes under again. The boy falls asleep by the pond, and his hair falls in. Part of his hair falls in, and it turns gold. So he wraps it up. Iron John comes back and says, "How you doing?" And the boy says, "Oh, I'm doing okay." And he says, "Anything wrong?" And the boy says, "Oh, no, everything's the same as usual." Iron John says, "Well, why do you have the band around your head?" And the boy says, "Well, okay, I stuck my head in the water." And so Iron John says, "Well, you failed miserably. You have to go. But if ever you want me for anything, come by the pond and give me a yell, and I'll be here." So that's kind of the start of the story. The boy comes back to the pond on a number of occasions for various reasons to seek out Iron John. So let me start. I hope you can see this. We're at a dismal loss of markers here. But it starts off with the pond thing. And Robert Bly's thing about the pond is that you go to the pond when you want to, when you really want to get serious about your life. He says a lot of people never go to the pond. So you go to the pond when you want to get serious about your life. And then you do what Robert Bly calls bucket work, which means if you want to find Iron John, you dig around with a bucket. You have to empty the pond bucket by bucket. And people like Carl Jung and other psychologists and philosophers talk about this bucket work, this piece by piece, getting into your life and into your what your life is about. So you have to do this kind of work. And to start off, the two-year-old boy is the essence of everybody. And the golden ball that he talks about is this. It's this spontaneity that all of us have, this ability to have a good time no matter where we are, no matter what conditions we're under, to find something funny going on. And so that's the basis of this whole story. And Iron John is that person that gets us in touch with that. As you see in the story, Iron John took the golden ball. So at some point in our life when we grow up, we learn to displace the wild man in us. We learn to not to suppress it, to fit in, to make good grades, to get a better job, to own a home, on and on. If there's any questions that you have, feel free to ask, and I'll answer them as best I can. This is a big book, and so I just kind of paraphrased it, and there's a lot of stuff that it covers. So is there anything you don't understand or would like to discuss further?
What's the pond?
Let me know.
Huh? What's the pond?
The pond is the self. The pond is your psyche, where where the well, according to Jung and other people, that's where your shadow is. And throughout this book, it basically says, if you don't deal with your shadow, you're living in a shallow existence. And it also says that society is about ignoring the shadow, getting people to pretend that there is no shadow, and to act to suppress the shadow. Robert Bly is not very kind to Christianity here either, although he's not against Christianity. He's more against the institutional church. He says that Jesus was one of the original wild men. He talked about John the Baptist as being one who baptized Jesus, the wild man, the man with all the hair and the eating locusts and wearing fuzzy clothes. This was the original wild man, or one of the wild men. Grimm's fairy tales, by the way, and all of this stuff predates Christianity by about 2,000 years. So Robert Bly makes a point of saying it's not that it's unchristian, it's just that Christianity didn't exist when a lot of this stuff came about.
What do you make of the fact that in the story, the key to the cage was on the mother's pillow?
Well, the key to, for men, the key to our manhood, that spontaneous child, is under our mother's pillow, which means to get it from out under your mother's pillow, you can't just say, Mom, can I have the key? She's going to say no. The fact is that you got to get this key from out under your mother's pillow. If it's under her pillow, that means she doesn't want you to have it. You can't go through your father and get it, because she's not going to give it to him either. So the only way to get it is to basically steal it from under your mother's pillow. And Robert Bly uses the example that very few mothers introduce their son. This is my son, Johnny. He's a wild man. You know, they like to say, this is my son, Johnny. He's a doctor. This is my son, Johnny. He's a lawyer. Which means that you've done all the right things to fit in, to make a good living, and to make your mama proud. And that is one of the things that suppresses the wild man. But you got to go to your mother and steal that key from her, because she's not going to give it to you. Yeah.
Just additional reflection on that. My understanding is that in order to find the wild man, it's sort of an assertion of masculinity, which you can't get from your mother at all. In fact, it requires that you detach and you, in a sense, reject the strictures of your mother in order to find that masculine self and individuate from a gender standpoint. And that's how I read that.
Well, I wouldn't say detach or reject. I mean, in the when we talk about initiation, part of the rites of initiation is that you have to break away, you have to bond with the mother and break away from the mother, bond with the father and break away from the father. It's not necessarily a rejection, it's a breaking away, getting out from under her skirt tails, basically. Did I see another hand?
It seems to me that key is also, I mean, probably that's what she wants to relinquish it, because that key would also be symbolic of her long-term security. By the son being the good son will support the mother in her old age because the husband is going to be dead by then.
Well, partially, but not necessarily. I mean, to live the life of a wild man is dangerous.
That's why she doesn't want to turn loose
of it. Well, yeah, but part of it is not so much security, it's just the fact that she doesn't want a dead son. You know, to get in touch with the wild man means to do sometimes dangerous things, because that's what men do.
That key also is the key to her security, so that's the reason that she wouldn't want to turn into it for herself.
I'd say that that's not the big deal of it. The problem is not necessarily hers. The problem is the son's. A mother is doing what any parent does, you know, tries to protect the kid from being hurt. Not so much for selfish reasons that the son can grow up and be a lawyer and, you know, buy her a condo or something. It's that she doesn't want to see the son beat up and battered.
But even more than that, she would like to see him continue to conform to her own image. And he needs to escape from that particular cage and unleash the wild man, which may be dangerous, but may simply be unpredictable.
Well, sort of, but Bly is really sensitive about blaming the mother, because then you get into Freud stuff, blaming the mother, and that's not the issue here. The issue is not to blame the mother. It's not her fault. She's doing what any parent does, tries to keep their child from being too wild.
Yeah.
I think I agree in a certain sense with this over here that the mother maybe is afraid of feeling lonely or feeling left, because statistically speaking, I don't know if it's always throughout history, statistically speaking, the male dies earlier than the female or whatever. But I did an interesting thing about 2 months ago, wrote to my mother and asked her what the most important things in life are. It'd be interesting. I'd be interested to hear what other men and women, for that matter, what their parents think are the most important things in life are. The first thing my mother said was to have raised her son successfully. And that tells me a lot about what you're talking about here. She wants me to be a doctor.
Well, yeah, to be raised successfully also that you don't get hurt, you know, that you don't fall in with a bad crowd.
Well, exactly. A wild man isn't necessarily successful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Certainly not by the world standards, because the world standard of success is to basically wipe out the wild man and have what Robert Bly goes on and on in his book about the new age man, and to have this soft, fuzzy new age man. You know. So mm-hmm. let me continue here. He talks about this in chapter 2. He talks about the raft, the axe, the wound, and the hare. The raft has to do with, if you read Huck Finn, you know, he's on this raft with this runaway slave, and they're headed down the Mississippi. Part of the the wild man goes out and hangs out with people who are not like him, you know, for far away places. And so that happens. And then the axe, there's an interesting story about the axe also, is that there's an African folktale about this man and his son goes out looking for hunting. And the man tells the son to stay there and he's gonna chase out a lion, and the son is supposed to chop the lion with the axe. So the son gets scared, and the first thing he sees, he chops with an axe, and it's a rat. And his father comes back, because the father has chased out a lion, but the son didn't, you know, chop the rat instead of the lion. And the father comes back and says, "What's up? You know, you're supposed to chop the lion." And the son says, "Well, I did," and holds up a rat. So the father gets really angry, and takes the axe, and hits the son with the axe. Literally gives the son a blow with the axe. And this is the blow that Robert Bly says all men have. In small group sessions, he would ask men, "Where did the axe land?" And men would pick out different parts of their body where the axe landed. Some men would say in their chest. Some men would say in their head. Some men would say in their foot or leg, or, you know, some crucial place, the groin, for men who feel like their sexuality has been dwarfed, you know. This is a crucial point, and it comes up throughout the book, you know, that where men had been wounded. And he talks about mothers as pouring salt on the wound of this man by shaming the boy in various ways. "You'll never be anything. You're just like your father. It's a good thing he did hit you." You know, that kind of thing. So here the man grows up with this wound has had salt poured on it by the mother. And the womb is, according to Bly, the womb is a very important thing, because the womb is where the males will give his greatest donation to society. Where your wound is where your genius will be. So a lot of men grow up suppressing the wound, hiding the wound, pretending that it's not there. And Bly says that where your wound is, that's where your greatest treasure is also. And then we get back to the hair thing. And that talks about the sensuality of hair. Hair stands for youth and sexuality, but it also stands for death, and it also stands for the unknown, or things that go on in our psyche, the growth that goes on in our psyche. He talks about how when you're asleep, your hair still continues to grow. You really don't have anything to do with the growth of your hair. And it's a masculine thing. He tells a few stories about how important hair is to young boys. Either you grow it out or you cut it off, or you wear it this way or you wear it that, but it's it takes on all these symbols. Before I go to chapter 3, any questions?
What's the significance of the gold?
Well, the gold just means it's treasure. It's a treasure, and it's valuable.
And why was it an axe that he put his finger in?
Say, why wasn't it an accident?
You said it was an accident, and he didn't say to the wild man that it was an accident.
Oh, well, he was ashamed to tell the wild man it was an accident, because the wild man made him promise not to touch the water. he was just supposed to sit there and wait for the wild man to come back. So.
Verlaine, can you give some examples of when you said where the wound is where the greatest treasure is, mm-hmm. where the greatest gift is? What are some examples of that?
Let me think. Can anyone think of any examples? I can't.
I'm not quite sure I understand what that means because I can't.
Well, I'll give you an example. Someone I mentioned yesterday who was a hero of mine was John Houston. And John Houston as a teenager was very sickly. As a kid, he was very sickly and almost drowned. But he lived to be 86. He was, you know, in those days, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, he was a man's man. He drank hard, chased women, fought, and he contributed these movies that always talked about people who started with nothing and became kind of like heroes, but then they kind of ended up with nothing too. But the whole movie was about the human spirit, the death of the human spirit. Someone else I think about, Muhammad Ali, you know, when he was a kid, someone beat him up and stole his bicycle. So he walked into the gym and just said, I want to learn how to fight so I can go get my bicycle back. You know, so that kind of stuff. And when you read about famous people, this kind of thing comes up all the time, that the wound that they had, either their, you know, Van Gogh, his depression was what gave him the impetus to paint, and you know, all of this sort of thing, it carries on. Yep.
How about as an example, does this work? A father tells his younger son, you never study, you never go to school, you never want to get good grades like your big brother. And belittles the younger son because he's stupid and he isn't going to make anything. And so the son goes on to become a great scholar or whatever, mm-hmm. sort of to overcome that wound that his father inflicted on his head.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, that kind of thing.
But he would have to also understand what happened to him. It wouldn't be that he just became a great scholar. It might be also that he understood why he did that and could.
Well, I'm not sure if it's so much an understanding thing. You have to come to grips with your wound. You know, you have to say, you know, I was a weak kid, and I don't want to be weak anymore. Like Jack LaLanne. Jack LaLanne was a skinny little kid, and then he became this big health guru. You know, well, you know, he just said one day, "I'm a skinny little kid. I don't want to be skinny anymore." You know, it wasn't a big. Well, this is not a big sort of analytical kind of thing. It doesn't have to be
going to the pond.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it's not, you know, it's no, none of this is heavier than it should be. Yes, sir.
My oldest son was very asthmatic growing up, and he went to yoga and became a teacher. And I asked him when he was about 3/4 of the way through, I said, why are you doing this? He says, Mom, don't you understand? It's how I deal with this problem. So,
this is
way of dealing with it.
Yes. I never heard that story before, but I know what my wound is, and I assume everybody else does too. That was extremely comforting to hear the promise that comes with that. You know, that someday that will be a contribution. Mm-hmm. That was a powerful experience for me to hear that.
And this works across the board. It isn't. This isn't just a male thing. I mean, this works. This works, you know, across the board. So, all right, let me move on to chapter 3. He talks about grandeur and sulking. Young boys have a great amount of grandeur. They think, you know, they're the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know, and. When that grandeur is wounded, which it invariably is, some older kid or something calls him a snot and pushes him out the door or something like that. You know, that kind of then sulking takes place. And this sulking can continue for years. You know, this sulking can cause him to focus in on the fact that somebody doesn't think he's the greatest thing in the world, and cause him to go into gangs or the mafia or real estate. And but this sulking takes place, and it talks about naivety. And then it leads into passiveness. He was naive to think that he was, you know, the greatest thing there was. And then once it is proven to him that he's not, he sulks, and oftentimes this goes into passiveness. And there's a lot of passiveness, according to Bly, in our modern day males. Mm-hmm. Men who are very passive towards their wives and their lovers and their children, who do all their fighting at the office and then come home and they're just kind of a blob. And Bly talks about you need a certain amount of, it takes more than a passive male to make decisions about who their children will play with, what kind of jackets their children will wear, helping the children with the homework, that sort of thing. It's not so much bravado and beating people up. It's kind of like life decisions. And this passiveness can just totally engulf men and last for a long, long time. We're talking 40s and 50s here. And Bly talks about kitchen work, that this passivity doesn't get overcome until we do kitchen work. And the kitchen work implies that there's a certain amount of going down deep into who we are. There's a certain kitchen work can be done intellectually, reading authors and that kind of thing, studying stuff that takes you down. But then it gets to these levels, the ashes in the kitchen and the corpse. There's a part in here where it talks about sleeping with the black darling, and the black darling in this story is a corpse that this man sleeps with. She's in the bed next to him, and he sleeps with her for a year. This corpse. Bly says that every man has a corpse, and the deal is when you go and you deal with ashes, you go and you get this corpse. You find this corpse. For some men, it's being shamed as a child by parents or by peers. For some men, it's physical abuse or sexual abuse or some kind of abuse. For some, it's a dream that they let go of so they could study accounting. You know. They may have wanted to go be jugglers and join the circus, but they gave it up because you can make more money doing accounting. You know? So there's this corpse that you go and you find in your ashes. And then learning to shudder. Talks about that's another step, learning to shudder. A lot of men, particularly passive men or macho men, and don't shudder. When they see something frightening, if you're macho, you go and you kill it, or you take it head on, or if you're extremely passive, you're just real cool about it, and it just doesn't faze you. But he talks about children when there's a woman in the village whose 2-year-old son saw the bear the other night, and just right away started crying. Says, "Mommy, Mommy, I saw an elephant." And she said, you know, it wasn't an elephant, but he knew that it was something, you know, he knew it was some kind of a wild animal. And that's what this talks about, the ability to shudder, the ability to see something dangerous and literally shudder, be afraid of it. And then going from the mother's house to the father's house, meaning is kind of what we talked about. There's a, you know, when you're a young boy, you grow up and your mother takes care of you and you get all your nourishment and everything from your mother. And then you move to, at some point you need to move to your father. That America does is turns the father into an idiot. And TV does this, has done it for a long time. You know, you see the bumbling idiot father and the mother comes along and she has a better idea. Or fathers who can't, you know, who can't even wear the right clothes anymore without their wives telling them what clothes to wear and that sort of thing. And he said at some point you have to move from your mother's house to your father's house and connect with your father. And then you get to what he talks about, the rat's hole, which is the bottom of the pit. And usually that implies a certain lack of status. It's not one of, at the kitchen level, you can be dealing with your, you know, at the kitchen work, you can be dealing with your ashes and stuff and still maintain a regular 9-to-5 job and wear your suit to work and your briefcase and still bring home the money and that kind of thing. But at this level, where you're at the rat's hole level, you're at a point where you can't hide it anymore. There's a certain loss of status where you've lost your job or your home or you're divorced and you don't have as much income as you used to have or something. But there is a lack of status at this rat's hole level. Any questions?
Well, what happens to a man or a boy if he doesn't have a father? I mean, say, my son was 11 when his daddy died. What happens? How can they move to the father's house?
Going to the father's house does not necessarily mean physically having a father. I mean, yes, it does within the nest. If the father dies, the son still has a father. That father just isn't there. And you retrieve the father by telling stories about the father, finding out from uncles and things what the father was like. Uncles can move in here and help you retrieve get in touch with your father. Grandfathers can do it. But it's real precise on the fact that women cannot do it. At some point, women cannot nurture men the way they need to be nurtured. And a lot of women are doing it. And what happens is that either the woman becomes hard trying to deal with, you know, young boys who are getting harder all the time. The woman becomes hard and she no longer is a woman. Or a feminine type of woman, the boy takes over the mother, and you see this acted out countless times. You know, there's a 15-year-old boy and he's bullying the mother. He won't do anything the mother says. She threatens to get his uncle or a neighbor or something, but he basically rules the roost. And this is what happens. It's gotten out of hand. He's never left the mother's house, and he's unruly. And at that point, in other societies, at that point, there are initiation rites, and we'll get into that a little later. What that's all about, but or other men come in and fill that gap.
Looking at the ashes and at the rat hole, when I was reading through this, the idea that came to my mind was that it was helpful in a way for men to have a reversal of fortunes, that to be fired or to have some kind of a major setback that sort of forced them back to their own resources and their own devices, took them out of their sort of programmed, on the way to be an accountant, on the way to be the doctor, on the perfect marriage and all of them doing the right things, and forced them to have to mourn and grieve and in a sense rediscover the original wound and heal the wound as an adult. And choose what that was really them and important to them at that point.
Yeah.
That was part of the function of this reversal and this f- falling backward and taking a step back.
It's important for men to grieve, and men don't grieve. America doesn't grieve. Bly talks about how America has never grieved for the Korean War, the Vietnam War, this latest war. We have never grieved for it. And he talks about Abraham Lincoln, who mourned the Civil War, who really grieved for the Civil War, and took our country through a period of grieving. And we don't grieve for anything in this country. And men, you know, if you're not grieving, then you're not in touch with the wound, and you become this kind of caricature. He lambasts people like Reagan and Walt Disney and you know, some other people, Bush, for not grieving, for giving us this facade of what man is.
I read today a comment from a speech that Abraham Lincoln gave in 1863 when we had a national day of a confession and fasting and mourning. And I thought, I couldn't imagine us doing that today, coming together corporately and confessing our sins.
Yeah.
And this was something just done, you know, just by everybody, government.
I used to live in Washington, D.C., and we a few times I was by the wall there on Memorial Day, and it's quite the sight to see. I mean, grown men crying and mourning. And Bly's thing is that if we had done this as a country, mm-hmm. maybe it would have spared some of the many after effects of the war. Men who have, you know, who were good boys and went away and in 2 months learned how to kill and were thrown in a foreign country and they killed everything in sight. And now they're back and they're supposed to be functioning people of society and they simply can't do it, you know. So, you know, he talks about this mourning period would have helped them get in touch with that sort of thing. Any other questions?
Question about, if I could retract back to the episode where he had visited the wild man at the swamp. Mm-hmm. His reentry back into the palace was through the kitchen. Mm-hmm. What does that mean in our society? How do men work in the kitchen today?
Well, the kitchen means not to be in charge, basically, to do grunt work, which a lot of men in our society see as, in our society in general, sees that as a shame. And that the only reason you do grunt work is because you have your eye on something else. I talked to a friend of mine who's in Hollywood. He works in Hollywood now, and he, you know, he started off there working in the cafeteria, but he knew full well that one day he wanted to be up in the head office. So he was just working in the cafeteria, kind of biding his time, making connections and stuff. But kitchen work means to be in the kitchen, to, you know, and that's it. You know, no one's going to listen to you make connections because you're in the kitchen. You know, you're a dirty, filthy mess, and you're working in the kitchen. It means to be at the bottom and struggling with what all that is.
What does it mean for a person who's established in their chosen profession? You want to revisit some of those issues.
Well, if you're established in your chosen profession, there are places you can go and you can be in the kitchen. You can work with the homeless. They'll treat you like a dog for, you know, a year. I mean, you work with any homeless group of people and they'll tell you in a minute what they think of you, you know. That's kitchen work. You know, you work with teens. They'll tell you in a minute what they think of you, you know. That's kitchen work. Some way where you can't, you know, you can't whip out your IBM computer and let everybody know that you're an executive and it means something. You know, to go in a place and work with you know, homeless teens and be scared because you know what you do out there doesn't mean a thing. You have to deal with them. Anything else? Okay, let me move to the fourth one. Father hunger and industrialization. He talks about that. He talks about men dealing with women deal with each other eye to eye. They sit down and they talk about stuff, and they look each other in the eye and talk. Men deal with each other shoulder to shoulder. Now, Bly says one is not better than the other. That's just the way men deal with it. That's the way women deal with it. Industrialization kind of put it into that, because the boy used to work shoulder to shoulder with his father on the farm. Industrialization took his father away from the farm to the city, where he goes away for 8 to 12 hours a day. The son has no idea, what he does, and so it leaves this hole, this father hunger. And he says this hole can fill up with demons, and if the son never sees or really knows what his father does. Sometimes the father can take the son to the factory and say, this is what I do, or bring the son to the office. But the son is at home hearing about how we're destroying the ozone. And his father's not home. And he assumes, maybe my father's out there destroying the ozone. You know? So that's the father hunger, and the industrialization does that. And then we get to the king. Is the fact that there's a king that all boys wanna see and wanna spend time with. But the king doesn't let you spend time with him unless you've done your work. And most people try to see the king without doing their work. I mean, and he has an example of maybe if you're in college or something. I remember once I was at I read a couple of James Cone's books. James Cone is this African-American writer who wrote Black Theology and God of the Oppressed, and he's a systematic professor at Union. And I was in New York and at Union, and I wanted to go see James Cone, and I had no idea what I'd say to him. But I just thought I'd just walk right in there and go, "Hello, James Cone, I'm Verlon Brown, I really like your books." Well, I couldn't get close to him. The secretary stopped me and said, "He's busy, go away," that kind of thing. Or a number of times, we tried to get close to the top people in our professions or whatever, and they just blow us off because we haven't done our homework, and we haven't done what we need to do to be in those people's presence. And Bly says that what you need to do, rather than try to go to the room of the king or these famous people, we should build a room of our own and have them come see us. And you get to the two rooms, and he talks about that in terms of fathers, is that a lot of times we have fathers and we have just dismissed them. They work all day, they don't have time for us, they're insensitive, that sort of thing, and we've dismissed them. Bly talks about there's two sides to fathers, and what we need to do is build a room in our hearts for the both sides of our fathers. This kind of mean, vicious side that kind of pushes us away, which he says is natural, because your father wants you to be a man, and if he pampers you or allows your mother to pamper you, you'll grow up to be a soft new age male. And so your father does certain things that get your goat or that don't allow you to have the easy way out. And it really, really bugs you. And that's a lot of times all people know of their father. And Bly says that's just one room of the house, of this place for your father. And he says the other room should be a place of all the things that your father has done for you that means something. And sometimes you have to reach back and find little things, like your father taught you how to swim, or your father took you to a ball game. One man said his uncle told him that his father was the only man who read books during the Depression. And things like this, and that show both sides of the father and give the father an extra room. And this it's the same with the king too. This extra room you need for the king and the father. He says most people don't get to know our fathers because we expect our fathers to come and stay in these little one-room apartments, and it's just not big enough. And then we get to the father's birth gift, and everybody's father gives them something at birth. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but whatever it is, you hold on to it, and it propels you and widens your view of your father. Maybe it's a quick temper or a quick wit or the ability to dance, something that comes natural. That's a gift that a birth gift that your father gives you. And then he talks about the walled garden. The walled garden is something.
Before you go on, I'm going to ask a question that's already been asked once. But what about the person whose father is dead, or whose father died when the person was very young, or died before the boy was even born? How does this work with the father who never had?
For those cases, the man is to do his homework. Ask uncles, mm-hmm. ask grandparents, ask the mother, what was daddy like? What was dad like? You know, what did dad like to do?
But he can never invite his father.
He can never invite his
father. He can never be in the two rooms. I mean, he can't do any of that.
Well, the two rooms is psyche stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. He can see both sides of his father. He may be carrying a big anger thing because his father died,
sure.
You know. But Robert Bly says if that's the only room you have, it's that anger room, then you need to get another room. And if that takes going to aunts and uncles and grandparents asking about your father, then that's what you need. That's the room you're building.
Okay.
Thanks. Another major theme along this line that's discussed in other books these days is about the mentor. Many times when there's an absent father, the father leaves, or he was an alcoholic and beat the wife and, you know, was put in prison or whatever happened to him, the son has no real interaction with the father, and or he's had a very limited and distorted one, and his father hunger results in seeking a mentor, whether it's a scoutmaster or a teacher or a coach or some other father substitute that can provide some of these same kinds of needs, not as well as their original father, but fill in that gap as opposed to kids, you know, going to gangs or getting drugs.
He talks about the mentor too, and he says you still need two rooms for the mentor because it's still the same thing. The mentor has a bad side and a good side, you know. So either way, you need two rooms. And yes, the mentor is very important, and that's where we all come in. All us men come in because at some point, we have to be mentors to young boys. And this guy named Robert Morris says, if you're not admiring a young boy, you're hurting a young boy. Mm-hmm. That as mentors, as adult men, we have to admire young boys. And at some point, we have to get rid of the wounded child. A lot of people are controlled by the wounded child. And that the wounded child has to be, the child is still wounded, and you could have memories of that, but you can't let your life be controlled by the wounded child. And and then you get into what's called the walled garden, and this is some of the stuff that he says middle-aged men need a walled garden, and a walled garden is basically a place where you go to feed yourself, a place where you go where you have secrets that you don't want to share with the rest of the world. Some men it's gardening, some men it may be golf, but it's got to be a thing some sacred space for yourself. It can't be competitive sports. It's got to be a sacred space for yourself, where you nourish yourself, you read what you want to read, you paint, you draw, you whatever, but that's your sacred space, and that's the walled garden. He says some boys Some men get a walled garden at a young age, but he says it's not really a walled garden. It's just a plant. This is something that doesn't come until you're middle aged, and you have a place to nurture yourself and take care of yourself and not let anybody in. He talks about it like a secret lover. If it's a lover and you don't want anybody to know when you're there, there's a certain amount of danger to it, and there's a certain amount of kind of nurturing that goes on that doesn't exist in some relationships. And he talks about that wall garden. And I've moved to chapter 5, but that's the whole thing is about this wall garden. Any questions before I move on to 6? I don't mean to be, I know I'm really zipping along, but I want to try to get through the whole book so you can get an overlay of the whole book. Okay, I'll move to 6 real quick. He talks about a sword, and he talks about a man cannot draw his sword unless he is able to live. He says one of the things our country does to men is they give them a sword before they know how to dance, and that if you don't know how to dance, you have no business with a sword. The military will give a sword to anybody, you know. But he says you don't get a sword unless you learn how to dance, and a lot of men feel like it's a shame to draw the sword. They're pacifists. They don't do that kind of thing. But he says a sword is to fight for something you love and something you believe in. And it doesn't necessarily have to be physical fighting, but it's a sword for something you believe in. A lot of people are fighting for stuff, but they don't know how to dance. They have a sword, but they don't know how to dance, which makes it kind of misguided. He talks about being copper. A lot of people are copper, a lot of men are copper in the sense that they're conductors for energy. And he gives the example of a man who puts his hand on his mother's chest and then one hand on the ground. And he takes that anger that the mother has towards the husband or life in general for whatever reason. Being a single parent or just how difficult it is to be a woman. And he becomes a conductor, or he puts his hand on his father's chest and puts one hand to the ground. Or he could stand with his hand in between his father and his mother, touching her breasts and his chest, conducting that energy back and forth. And he talks about how that's viewed as being sensitive and understanding. You can be a gentle, you can get awards for being gentle, but unless you bring out the warrior and learn how to fight, you will be copper. And the thing is to get from copper to iron. And there's a section he talks about eating needles, and that there's a lot of iron in needles. There's a lot of iron in eating dust and dirt and getting gritty and fighting, and that will get you from the copper state to the iron state, which is where you want to be, is Iron John. He talks about opposites, a lot of people want to come down and, well, I'm a man, or you know, I'm a woman, or I'm a feminist, I'm macho or whatever, and his thing is to get in there and realize that there are opposites, and that you can most certainly deal with opposites. And then he talks about choosing, and this is where your warrior comes in as well. It doesn't matter what you do, at some point you have to choose and then fight for it. If you choose to be a dentist, then you have to fight for whatever it is means to be a dentist. That means keeping late hours, going to school, looking in people's mouth you'd rather not look into, whatever. That's part of it. And then that's the warrior part that decides that. Let me just go through this real quick, and if there's questions we can ask. Initiation, the Great Mother sequence. He talks about initiations in primitive cultures where it's a big deal. I mean, when a kid becomes initiation age, and they can kind of tell it because the kid kind of sasses the mother. And so the men get together and they plan this whole thing, this initiation thing, and it's a long process. And he says a license won't do it, bar mitzvah doesn't do it, confirmation doesn't do it. The boy has to be taken away from the familiar and in a place where he's afraid, and he doesn't know if he's going to get to the other side or not, and where there's bonding with males. And then we get into the great mother sequence, the red, the white, the black. The red is intensity, the white is engagement, the black is humanness. And we may ride these horses at different times, but to be stuck in one is the bad thing. And he talks about a lot of men are stuck in the white. And this he picks on pastors and priests, that they're stuck in the white and they're roaming around making everybody happy. And nobody wants to see a priest or a pastor who's too red, who's too intense. They don't like that. Politicians don't want to hang in the black too much. I mean, if you want a good public image, public relations image, you don't hang around in the black too much, because that means mourning and that means dealing with the dark side of things. So you always present this white image, and there's a lot in our society that pushes us to continue to dish out this white image when oftentimes we need intensity or we need humanness. And then the last one is eight, the wound. The same thing about getting in touch with your wound and what that is all about, what that is. And the wild man is not in you, but the wild man is someone to get in touch with. He says a lot of people make the mistake by trying to be the wild man, but all that leads to is confusion and an early death. You cannot be the wild man. And then he talks about living with the king. And what that means is that if your warrior has successfully chose something and decided to fight for it, this dead king on the floor will get up because that... That king is that king was not dead inside of you. That king was just on the floor asleep, waiting for a reason to get up, or waiting for you to choose and to fight for something you want rather than what mom says or what society says or that sort of thing. But he lays it all at our feet in terms of initiating our young men. And he talks about gangs and how people go into gangs, kids go into gangs, because they want adventure. Young boys get to a point where they want adventure. And they go into gangs and they go into all of these hostile forces because we as men, you know, we're putting in 12, 16 hours a day working, trying to buy stuff for the kids, and that's not the issue. So, that's that. Any questions? Yes.
Can the wild man be unleashed without deprivation and hurt? I mean, say if everything is a stable environment and essentially have everything you need and want, and life is too easy, can the wild man be unleashed without hurt and deprivation?
No. He says that you'll never get in touch with the wild man with 175 cable channels. If you're too comfortable, the wild man will not come out. But what will happen is that you might as well be in a gang in terms of the respect you have towards, you know, your mother and your peers, because what you have is a spoiled child inside you.
So maybe that's not on point, but how do you break the cycle and get essentially be a mentor to someone else and get them in touch with the wild thing?
Well, there are things out there. There's like Outward Bound. Those are kind of organized things. Get them away from the comforts, the cable television, the boom boxes, the CDs, all of that stuff. that, you know, you go in your son's room and it's all there. You know, get them away from that, or refuse to buy it for them. Make them work for it. You know, sure, you can, you know, you can have a CD player if you want to work for it. You know, that's what I'm going to do.
What should the mothers do?
The mothers should recognize that there is a point at which her son needs to be nurtured by men. And if that means calling an uncle, seeing that an uncle spends time with the son, or you know, doing something to connect that son with men. You know, whether that's getting them in the Boy Scouts, whether that's getting them in the Outward Bound, or whatever. But to recognize that that son breaking away from her is not a bad thing.